This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. If it works for you, or even if it doesn't, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're asking if countries in Europe should be preparing for a day when the United States leaves NATO, an organisation that President Trump has described as obsolete. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. For example, the recent one about the difficulties the British Armed Services are having in finding new recruits. Just type BBC Briefing Room into your favourite search engine. Anyway, for now, take your seat in The Briefing Room. Donald Trump arrived in Brussels yesterday to talk to his allies. He started out very disgruntled, trashed the Germans, but then went away apparently happy.
Tremendous progress has been made. Everyone's agreed to substantially up their commitment. They're going to up it at levels that they've never thought of before.
So everything is hunky-dory with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Today, at least. President Trump has in the past described it as obsolete. This is unprecedented language from an American president, and there seems to be a fundamentally different attitude from this White House to the Western Alliance. So, how seriously should the European members of NATO take this? Should they be preparing, can they prepare, for the possibility of a European defence without the United States? Step into the briefing room and find out. First, I want to know how NATO came into being at all. What was it for? I invited Elizabeth Brewer into the briefing room to tell us. She's an expert on European security at the consultancy Control Risks.
So in 1948, which is now 70 years ago, there was a huge crisis in Berlin. The Soviets, who were occupying the eastern part of Germany, decided to block all access for any goods going into West Berlin. The Allies came together, the Brits and Americans primarily, and performed a stunning feat of delivering through the so-called Berlin airlift. It was a really impressive feat of solidarity with those West Berliners.
50,000 flights to Berlin, carrying 250,000 net metric tons of food and supplies for the people of the Western sector.
As a result of that, it dawned on the Allies that they really should become more serious about this thought of forming an alliance. The next year, so 1949, NATO was founded, the North Atlantic Treaty Association, essentially by the Allies who had stuck together during World War II and a few countries that had been occupied by Germany.
In the Pentagon in Washington, the North Atlantic Defense Committee, composed of the 12 Atlantic Pact nations, meets for the first time.
There is this famous saying, NATO was created to keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out. And in fact, that's really how NATO was founded. Now, it had three official purposes, which was to deter Soviet expansionism, so to keep the Russians out, forbidding the revival of nationalist militarism in Europe, which I think is essentially saying keep the Germans down, and to keep a strong North American presence on our continent, so keep the Americans in. And that's exactly what happened. Now, so in 1963, there was a seminal moment in NATO history, the Cuban Missile Crisis. the Americans discovered that the Soviets had put missiles on Cuba, which is very close to the US, and it drove home the point that NATO territory, in this case the US, was not safe from Soviet aggression. NATO needed a centralized and strong military infrastructure and, of course, regular exercises. Large numbers of American soldiers and other NATO soldiers based in Germany, they constantly exercise together day and night. I was speaking to a British former officer the other day. He said, "We knew the name of every animal in the forest. That's how well prepared they were."
And one engineer has literally started hammering into the Berlin Wall, making a first incision.
On the 9th of November 1989, the Berlin Wall collapsed. And that set in motion a hugely important set of events. And eventually it resulted in the Soviet Union itself collapsing in 1991.
Good evening. 11 Soviet republics agreed to form a new Commonwealth of Independent States today and consigned the Soviet Union to history.
So now NATO had an identity crisis. So what do you do if you're a successful alliance and, in fact, you're so successful that you don't have any enemies anymore? But NATO remained in existence, and that then later proved a good thing when conflicts emerged in Europe again. Nobody realized that a country like Yugoslavia could fall apart so disastrously that it would cause wars, but that's what happened. And so it wasn't NATO territory, but after a while, NATO was called upon to intervene with military means by bombing and keeping the peace. Those two Balkan missions also helped NATO redefine what it was about, because this was not about territorial defense. It was just about maintaining stability in Europe, even in the sort of farther corner of Europe. And that then helped NATO, I think, also prepare for the new missions that came along with Afghanistan.
Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center.
9/11 is a key moment in NATO history. It's not a traditional military attack, clearly. It's a terrorist attack. But NATO has something called Article 5, which means that when one ally is attacked, all the other allies come together to respond to that attack. It's quite interesting, I think, when Donald Trump talks about the lacking solidarity within NATO and how European allies don't pull their weight, that in fact the only conflict where NATO has invoked Article 5 is really Afghanistan, and a number of NATO allies really came to the aid of the United States. Today, NATO is back in what one might call territorial defense mode again, and that really dates back to 2014 with Russia's annexation of Crimea and the conflict in East Ukraine, when it dawned on the rest of Europe that really land warfare is not over, and in fact, it could affect any member state or any other European country, and we are all woefully underprepared for such a situation.
Elizabeth Brough. Now, the facts and figures. Mr. Trump claims that the United States is paying way over the odds for the security of Europe, and the Europeans have been taking advantage of American generosity. To what extent is he right? Nick Childs is a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Nick Childs, just as a matter of fact, is Europe now spending less or more on its defence than previously?
Well, everyone took a big, what was known as a peace dividend in the aftermath of the Cold War. So that saw all defence budgets drop from those levels. There's been a significant increase in the last 2 or 3 years, in part because Mr. Trump has put the pressure on, but actually it preceded that. It was more to do with Mr. Putin than Mr. Trump, and a sense that the situation in Europe had changed, the security situation had changed, and there needed to be a signal that NATO was responding to that. So defence budgets have been going up again in Europe, but still not back to that level of about 10 years ago.
So what were they 10 years ago, let's say, as a percentage of GDP? What did they fall to, and what are they now?
Well, if you take the UK, for example, they were pretty close to 3% at that time. It's dropped down now to around 2%. So the UK is, as far as NATO is concerned, one of the good guys in all of this. And one must remember that the pledge that was put forward in 2014 was to move towards that goal. So that's the key.
OK. Does something like a 2% figure for everybody involved, does that actually really make any sense in military and expenditure terms, or is it essentially a political gesture?
It was clearly meant to be a significant political signal that Europe was taking seriously the need to respond to a different security environment, essentially, and to reinvest in its capabilities. But the key is what the outputs are, i.e. what military capability you're delivering. And on that, European countries prioritise very different things. So actually, one of the key goals of NATO is that countries should spend at least 20% of that defence budget actually on equipment and research and development, so improving those military capabilities. So that is where, actually, in some ways, a lot of the focus should be. It's turning spending into real capabilities.
What could we say about the quantity of US military expenditure and effort that actually does go directly into the defence of Europe?
It's complicated. We've done some work that shows that out of the total defence budget of the United States, which is about $600+ billion, direct spending in terms of forward presence, troops actually on the ground in Europe, aircraft, ships deployed forward, total spending for NATO in that context is about $36 billion, which is only about 5% of the total global US defence spending. But that's obviously not the total story. Clearly, part of that linkage is the fact that what NATO is getting from the United States is that overall umbrella of access to the total capability that the US can bring, what used to be called the transatlantic bridge, essentially. Most of that spending, of course, is US national interest spending, you know, with the nuclear arsenal of the United States dropped significantly. If it wasn't formally a part of NATO, probably not. With the Navy or the Army or the Air Force dropped significantly, probably not.
Now, if the Americans were not involved at all, is Europe, as it is now, in any position to defeat a Russian invasion?
It really rather depends on what that threat is and where it takes place and how it unfolds. But it, certainly in the terms in which you set it out there, it would be extremely difficult for the European countries on their own to respond effectively in the way that NATO can respond now with the United States. And it's not just the numbers involved. It's the fact that what Europe gets from the US defence umbrella is a whole spectrum of capabilities that the United States as a superpower is investing in that enables it to respond. It is numbers of aircraft, but it's also those one could call them exotic capabilities of stealth fighters, precision weaponry, plus all the enabling things like strategic airlift and the tankers that support ongoing operations and support bringing in reinforcements that individual European NATO countries don't invest in the same way to any significant degree.
Nick Childs. As we heard earlier, NATO was founded in order to counter a very specific threat, the Soviet Union, a specific threat that's now disappeared or at least mutated. But with American support apparently more conditional, how should Europe think about defending itself? What kind of threat should it be preparing for? Joining me now in the briefing room is Filippo Costa Buranelli from the School of International Relations at the University of St Andrews. Filippo Costa Buranelli, can you tell me about how the nature of the threat has changed from the Soviet threat as it was to the Russian threat as is now?
Back in the days during the Cold War, the threat that the Soviet Union was posing to the Western world and to NATO and to the allies in this part of the world was extremely existential and was deeply ideological. This is not the case anymore. The threat that Russia is posing to the West nowadays, differently from the Cold War, is more of a threat deriving from a lack of status that is perceived from Russia. It's something that runs deeply inside Russia's establishment, Russia's leadership. It has to do with parity, with equality of status. Russia wants to be seen as a great power. So while, again, during the Soviet times, the nature of the threat was, as I said, ideological, but also based, again, on military catch-up and mutual nuclear deterrence, for example, now the nature of the threat is very much sub-threshold.
What do we mean by sub-threshold?
That it doesn't lead to full military escalation, but certainly contributes to a sense of destabilization and a sense of danger in the West.
Do you mean that, whereas in the old days, NATO would have had to have prepared for the possibility of Soviet military action if things had gone wrong, these days the threat is much more likely to be a cyber threat, an internet threat, the use of covert means to destabilize, and that therefore we should worry less about tanks and planes and rockets?
On the one hand, I would say yes. What we are observing nowadays is a more subtle way of conducting conflict. It relies on miscalculation and misinterpretation. Peacetime and wartime are now blurred. The other side of the answer is that in Cold War times, things were always on the edge of conflict, but overall the framework of action was very much predictable. War politics was divided into two camps, the liberals and the commies, the blues and the reds, and everything was very much interpretable. Nowadays, the issue of predictability is very much at stake.
No, indeed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've been dealing with the consequences of this nerve gas attack with the Novichok agent. How does one fit events like that into the pattern of Western defence?
It was a massive attack on UK's sovereignty. You really have the feeling that European states, when it comes to dealing with Russia and with respect to dealing with a common answer to these threats that are coming from Russia, are somehow losing the compass. They don't really know how to react because every single European state has different perceptions of these threats. So in the context of defense, it's very difficult to find a compromise because states are attracted by unilateral solutions, for example, hence undermining multilateral solutions.
You mean some of them would like to try and deal with Russia themselves on a one-to-one
Absolutely.
Basis? Let's look beyond Russia, because presumably there are threats that the members of NATO face that are not Russia.
Yes, one can look at cross-border terrorism. For some countries within the NATO alliance, cross-border terrorism should be the priority. Dealing with Iran, for example. The rise of populism is a threat that NATO faces as an organization. This skepticism towards, again, the very notion of collective security is undermining NATO's coherence.
So what you're suggesting is that the answer to this is not, if you like, looking at the military capacity of NATO all the time, but is looking at the political and educational role of NATO in maintaining unity for common values.
I'm not discarding at all the military component of this framework of action between NATO and Russia. The military component is very much there. What I'm trying to point at is it's a matter of values, it's a matter of interpretation of norms, it's a matter of educational diplomacy in a way, to understand the function of NATO again, to understand the role of NATO, and to really try to find a way to converge around a set of core values that need to be preserved.
Filippo Costa Buranelli. The threats and risks are changing, but what shape is NATO in today, as presented in this week's summit, to deal with them? This morning, no sooner had President Trump made his claims about his huge victories than President Macron of France seemed to contradict him by saying that countries were just adhering to previous plans. It all seems a little precarious. Tomáš Valašek comes from Slovakia, a country that was once part of the Warsaw Pact and which saw Russian tanks on its streets in 1968. He was Slovakia's permanent representative to NATO and he's in Brussels. Tomáš Valašek, what's your impression of the summit?
It's been actually a strangely good one for the alliance, in a sense that, of course, all of the predictable drama happened, but at the end of the day, they were on all the usual disagreements, right? Low defense spending in Europe, the different pipelines that should or should not be running from Russia to Western Europe, really, if you change the tone and if you change the body language, this could have been Barack Obama or George Bush making those points. And the implication thereof is that, at least for now, Donald Trump isn't acting on his instincts. I mean, the little we know about him, he doesn't seem to really believe in the idea of alliances or permanent friends or permanent enemies. But he's not turning that into U.S. policy. He creates crises to score political points back home with the audience, with the voters. But at the end of the day, the things that have been agreed, if anything, made NATO stronger than it was 2 days ago. So there's this odd disconnect between the bellicose rhetoric but the sort of fairly happy reality of NATO as we speak.
Is there a danger of being complacent here in the sense that Trump's style is peculiar, but what might lie behind it actually is the beginning of the disengagement the European leaders have long feared?
We don't just worry about his style. We actually worry about what he actually thinks and what he does appear to think. One of his oldest held beliefs, one that he has written about for 3 decades, is that alliances are bad for the United States, that in the end the Allies just end up ripping off the Americans. So we worry that his heart is not in NATO. What hangs over all of this is the uncertainty whether he would actually use and risk U.S. lives on behalf of Europe if Europe was in some sort of a crisis.
Do European leaders believe that if you were Vladimir Putin, you would be more likely to take a chance on some form of attack in Europe if there was a crisis under Donald Trump than you would, let's say, if it was George W. Bush?
Yes, the answer is unequivocally yes. The Russian government and the Russian president have more reasons than in recent memory to believe that NATO is vulnerable because the US might not be committed. But at the end of the day, they don't know. And the risk of getting it wrong mean that the consequences for Russia are catastrophic. What's different with this president and what unnerves us in Europe is the possibility or the reality that for the first time in recent history, we have a U.S. president who seems willing to walk away from it all, who doesn't seem to genuinely believe that America's interest is in fighting for Europe. We just don't know what president would do in time of crisis, and there are decisions he has made, such as on pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, when he hasn't just, you know, it wasn't just talk. He did actually make consequential decisions. There is no Iran deal. He has essentially killed it.
Prudentially, do you think Europe should be planning for a NATO potentially without the US? Is that realistic?
I wouldn't imagine planning, because anything that's done officially and visibly in this space risks becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think it is time for quiet conversation and reflections on what would be due in case of the unthinkable if the United States decides that it has no business fighting for Europe. That would require changing UK and French nuclear policies to very clearly commit themselves to use nuclear weapons on behalf of the rest of the NATO member states, and that particularly for France would be quite revolutionary. It would require, frankly, a command and control network, the likes of which we don't have in Europe and are unlikely to build because of the expenses and the expertise involved. We would probably have to have an agreement with NATO on using the existing NATO one. And it would almost certainly require defense budget increases above and beyond what President Trump wants from us, well above the 2% to really truly make up in the European theater with the European means for what the US provides currently.
Tomasz Walaszek. Finally, what's the view from the United States? Heather Connolly served in the US State Department during the George W. Bush administration and is down the line from Washington. Heather Connolly, does Trump represent the start of a new pattern of American attitudes towards its allies and specifically NATO?
Well, see, that's a great question, because there's an incredible amount of continuity in what President Trump has been saying. He is just saying it in the most abrupt, abrasive way. It has been for decades. Every American president has strongly pushed Europe to increase its defense spending, and you can argue gosh, it really didn't work that very well. We haven't seen dramatic upticks. But it is put in such a way that my concern is the methodology ends up actually eroding U.S. national security. It erodes the structures that actually help keep Americans safe and help Americans increase their economic prosperity.
The impression I think that European leaders may be under is that President Trump is the first president for some time who does not see the defense of Europe as a defense of America itself.
Well, yes, I completely agree with that. But I would actually take a step back and say this is the first American president since really the First and Second World War that does not view allies as something that is in America's interest. He sees allies as a complete drain, and that's completely new.
So the question is this new perception simply his? And when he goes, it goes with him? Or because it's proved to be popular with the American people or a section of the American people, is it about to become the view of a wider section of the American polity?
Well, I think that is the question, and I think that's what we're going to have to find out. The president does absolutely capture the sort of public spirit and public mood. There is a great fatigue across the United States. This comes from 17 years at war in Afghanistan, a perceived failure of effort in Iraq, that whenever there's a problem in the world, the U.S. is the one that has to respond, and no one else comes, and there's this perception of why us. So there's so many different threads coming into this. It's very hard whether the next U.S. president will just carry on to what President Trump represents and stands for in his policy approach, or whether, as in the past three U.S. presidents, the next person elected usually focuses on undoing what his predecessor just did.
Well, let's just imagine for a moment that I'm the national security advisor to a new prime minister in London, and I phone you up and I say, Heather, what should I be advising here? What should I be planning for? Should I be saying to the prime minister, look, we should begin to envisage possibly even a NATO without the United States?
Look, this is a time now where every country has to be crystal clear on what is in their national security interests. And then Europe will have to take very important steps to ensure that they can protect their own national security interests, which means an increase in defense spending. It means protecting borders. It just may not be an actively engaged partnership with the U.S. as it used to be.
Does it also mean, for instance, not necessarily expecting the United States to take your side in a dispute with Vladimir Putin?
Well, yes. European countries are going to have to be prepared, as Angela Merkel has said, to go it on their own. If President Trump at the Helsinki summit makes some broad statements, let's imagine it's the recognition of Russia's annexation of Crimea, there is going to have to be a very loud and bipartisan and unified response from Congress to say no, the United States of America will never recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea. I think if the president goes too far, Congress will have to impose legal restrictions, basically take policy away from the president. That is the only thing that can be done in the near term. And we just hope our allies remain united and strong. If President Trump does offer President Putin a lot at the Helsinki summit.
That advice seems to me to add up in the end to prepare for the worst, but talk to everybody in Congress that you can.
America's spending in Europe to help defend the transatlantic relationship from Russian aggression has gone up. So there is strong support here, but the damage that the president is doing, so deeply eroding confidence in this alliance, cannot be understated. I think we need to go forward, though, in confidence. And hopefully America's leaders will speak out clearly on this. And we hope our European allies understand that the country has other perspectives than just the president's comments.
Heather Connolly in Washington, D.C. So to sum all that up, we don't seem to know if Trump is a one-off. And for NATO members, at the very least, it seems prudent to plan for the possibility that he may not be. To plan, in other words, for a defence without America. My thanks to Elizabeth Braun, Nick Childs, Filippo Costa-Buranelli, Thomas Valaschek and Heather Connolly. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Olivia Beasley. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And we really do enjoy hearing from you.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.